Is it a good time to be investing in tech for businesses? Well, yes, because AI is so revolutionary. I don't fear for the human in the chain as much as some people do, although I understand maybe if I was a factory worker, I might have more to worry about. Or if I was a lawyer, I wouldn't want to be a lawyer right now. One minute they announce a large language model that blows everything up to that point out of the water. Next, their CEO has been fired. Then he's back.
It was a bit of a mess, wasn't it?
It's incredible, isn't it?
From the first-time founders to the funds that back them, innovation needs different. Our episode partner, HSBC Innovation Banking, is proud to accelerate growth for tech and life science businesses, creating meaningful connections and opening up a world of opportunity for entrepreneurs and investors alike. Discover more at www.hsbcinnovationbanking.com/en-gb. Hello and welcome to the UKTM podcast, a weekly chat with the movers and shakers of the UK tech industry and the destination for all things UK tech related. I'm your host, Jane Wakefield, and joining me this week is Jason Bradbury, probably best known as one of the original hosts of Channel 5's The Gadget Show. Welcome, Jason.
Hi, Jane. Great to be here.
Now, why was it that The Gadget Show was such a hit? What is it that we loved about gadgets? And has that kind of changed? Because are we now living in a sort of almost a post-gadget era?
That's a really good question. So to answer the first question, based on the way that people come up to me, even now, 20 years since the first ever episode of The Gadget Show, and about 6 to 7 years since I left, they're still coming up to me on the street. And they're sort of wide-eyed, really excited to see us. And I think it was the gang show kind of concept. So the idea, a little bit like Top Gear, it was the interaction between the presenters, I think, and the fun element of it, the fact that it was a bit zany, that we did silly things like, you know, blow up hard drives to see if they would, you know, still have your data on them, or dangle, you know, protective phone cases over a volcano, or put jet engines on a skateboard. So there was a zany quality to it. I also think that one of the main things that we miss in the digital age is scarcity, isn't it? I was thinking this yesterday as I binged on various episodes of, I forget what I was watching on Netflix, Game of Thrones thing on Prime, and I was like 4 episodes in, and it's a bit like having access to all the chocolate you'd ever want to eat. There was a scarcity to The Gadget Show, wasn't there? So you waited a week to find out A, what was on, and B, you didn't get to choose what was on as a viewer. You had to sort of take what you were given. And I think that meant there was a level of variety. There were some surprises and scarcity. All of those factors mixed in made it really popular.
And presumably you were there for the launch of the iPhone, which many people see as being kind of one of the most seminal moments in the last sort of decade. What were your thoughts on that, and how that's changed to now being that there's not many big radical changes in the phones we all have in our pockets?
I agree. I think the last 3 iterations of the iPhone are effectively the same thing. And the feature set that they are selling to us doesn't really work. As in, it doesn't do the act of selling much good, because it doesn't elicit a reaction in me. I mean, I'm more interested in, say, the Vision Pro, because they're taking a whole new, you know, stab at a new sector, than I am whatever the latest iPhone is. I mean, case in point, I think my iPhone is certainly 2, maybe 3 generations old.
Yeah, mine too.
I think so. When I was one of the, if not the first journalist in the UK, one of the first journalists to have my hands on the iPhone. I seem to remember it coming with a security guard in a kind of locked case. And would you believe, and I'm not making this up, I'm being serious, it was tied to my hands. I was thrown off a suspension bridge, and they said, well, they reckon it's the easiest phone ever designed to operate. Well, you've got to find out how to turn it on. Text message, pull me up. And that was the truth. I was on a bungee cord on a suspension bridge. And Susie was on the comparable Nokia smartphone at the time. What was it, the N95? I can't remember what it was. It blew my mind. I mean, on the one level, it blew my mind. From a design ethos, it was like something from the future, wasn't it? You know, Johnny Ives knocked the ball out of the park with the design of the iPhone. But I remember thinking it wasn't particularly feature rich. I think if you actually look at the feature set on the first ever iPhone, it doesn't do a great deal other than be a phone. It was a pretty good phone, but it wasn't much much good at a great deal of other stuff, like internet and all the rest of it. Obviously, it was a good music device. But a lot of the features that we would possibly suspect it had, like a really quick data connection and you know, good internet experience, were not there on the initial phone.
Yeah, and it's only grown in time, hasn't it, to be a kind of device that we all rely on for everything, our kind of go-to computer, I suppose. It's quite interesting, isn't it? Because obviously the Gadget Show is very much a consumer show. Our audience is sort of more businesses, startups.
Do you
think that businesses are now in an era where it's very difficult to kind of know what they need to buy, what kind of gadgets they need to acquire? I mean, you mentioned the Apple's
Vision Pro.
I mean, that could have huge implications for businesses, couldn't it? But it's also hugely expensive.
Yeah.
And you know, it's a difficult time, isn't it, for startups and businesses trying to kind of make the most out of technology?
I'd say yes and no, if I'm honest. I mean, certainly in terms of imaging devices, if you're in that game. I mean, I did an event at the Excel last week for travel agents, and so I was talking a lot about imaging in terms of, you know, things like the Vision Pro and more what might come next. That I feel the next iteration of the Vision Pro is the one to really look out for. Similarly, actually, with the iPhone, if you think about it, you know, the first iPhone was novel and exciting and felt like a piece of jewelry compared to the kind of less poetic design, product design from the likes of Nokia and Sony and so on, Sony Ericsson as it was. But then it actually came into its own, didn't it? And I think the Vision Pro is going to do that. It needs to be less expensive, possibly half the price. And I believe possibly a little lighter and a little thinner. Possibly maybe not quite as luxuriant, you know, the materials that they've used. It's a beautiful thing, but really you pay for that with your £3,500 price tag, whatever it is. So yeah, I would say it depends what you're doing, really. But obviously, forgive me, it's got to be AI, isn't it? That's why I said yes and no. So the yes, the no is AI, meaning double negatives forgiven. You asked, you know, is it a good time to be investing in tech for businesses? Well, yes, because AI is so revolutionary. So obviously it depends what you do. And I understand AI comes with all kinds of ethical questions, doesn't it, around the workplace, at the very least the workplace. And then it even gets into the ethics of how safe is it for us to explore without boundaries this incredibly powerful new explosive technology. But I think for business, it's extraordinary. I was using a natural language engine this morning, a popular platform, LLM, large language model, and I was using, what was I using it to do? Oh yeah, to define a question around a business idea I've got, and the question was, what problem am I trying to solve? And I couldn't, so I'll be honest with you, the issue I've got is I'm trying to get a movie funded, which you might surprise you, but it doesn't matter what it is that I'm doing. But my business approach is, what's the problem? Because that drives all the marketing, doesn't it? And the website, you know, you try and get that subtle question resolved in potential investors' minds. What's the problem that this is going to solve for me, right? Well, when you come to a movie, for example, that's quite a difficult ask, isn't it? What problem does a movie solve? It doesn't really, does it? It feels like kind of butter on the toast. You can still have the toast without the butter. You can still not watch a movie. So why invest in it? And I was having a really interesting philosophical conversation with the large language model this morning around that issue. So there you go. The case in point, my business, it plays the role of an expensive second person that I can brainstorm with.
And did it give you some good ideas? Just sort of back up the ideas you'd already had yourself, or come up with some new ones?
Well, look, I was trying to resist not PRing my movie, but I'm going to do it now. my film, believe it or not, is a British comedy, a feature-length feature film called Control AI Delete, and it's about a bunch of retro gamers who are humanity's last hope against a rogue AI that's rolled out. Sounds pretty prescient, isn't it? And they use 80s and 90s gaming computers to fight back against the AI, right? So it's loads of fun. Set in Skegness. It's going to be great. We've got loads of amazing people attached to it, and we're going to try and crowdfund it in September. But what it came back with is it was talking about the power of nostalgia and how the movie was reminiscent of the great sort of adventure movies and tech movies from the 1980s and 90s, like Hackers and Terminator and War Games. And that's what the AI came back with, which I don't know what you think. I reckon that's a pretty good solution.
I think it, yeah. And also it's kind of interesting that you think of nostalgia as being a uniquely human kind of thought process, don't you? So that's interesting.
God, what a great idea. Yeah. Does an AI, so the AI suggested nostalgia, but does the AI really understand
what it's talking about? Well, that's,
I mean, no, how could it? It couldn't understand nostalgia, could it?
No, not unless it's getting jealous of the sort of good old days of AI back in the era of IBM.
Yeah. Chatbots back in the day before we passed the Turing test.
Oh, back in my day.
Heady days. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I suppose the difficulty for businesses when they're navigating this new era of AI is, first of all, there's an awful lot of hype out there, isn't there? There's an awful lot of firms that have put the title AI in their kind of offering and, you know, are promising to transform businesses. That can be tricky for businesses, especially young startup businesses, to navigate. And then you've also got established names like Microsoft, who've obviously got very established products like Copilot, which now has AI, but it's not cheap. So, you know, it's a really difficult kind of thing to navigate for businesses, isn't it? Where do you think that they should go, especially as you mentioned with the bigger ethical questions and the fact that we all have our phones, whether it's our iPhone or our Android, on which we can use all these large language models at the drop of a hat without having to ask our companies and our businesses whether we should. So there's lots of different tiers of things to worry about there, isn't there?
Yeah, it's a bit like the kind of gold mining days, isn't it? You know, when everyone was heading, well, I'm guessing they were heading west. My geography of the North American continent is not great. But
go west, there you go.
And in that everyone's kind of trying to find their feet and look for the most cost-effective, productive way of deploying AI. But I think you do need to be looking. I don't think there are many industries other than, say, the, you know, some, if you're, you know, if you're in the business of making things, or, you know, sort of arts and crafts style thing. If you're a small company, for example, and you make, you know, prints, or you're a photographer, I don't think AI has much to offer other than the need for you to distinguish the human in the chain. And I mean this sincerely. I really mean this. I see this a lot because I talk about technology all the time in all different contexts. And would you believe, mainly to business. So forget my role as the gadget show guy. Really, since I left the gadget show, the way that I've earned a living is by doing talks about transformative technologies to businesses. And now, of course, it's all AI. And one of the themes that I often talk about is the rollback that we experience. And the best example would be the fact that now we enjoy standing in line for, what, 7 minutes while, generally a bearded barista with lots of tattoos painstakingly makes our coffee, rather than just pressing a button and grabbing one, which, of course, is also available. But the choice generally that people make is to go for the proper coffee in a proper coffee. I'm going into old drama class elocution lessons now. A proper cup of coffee from a barista. And, you know, and that's a pushback, an intentional pushback. And we're getting that already, aren't we, in terms of the creative arts pushing back against AI. So I don't fear for the human in the chain as much as some people do, although I understand maybe if I was a factory worker, I might have more to worry about. Or if I was a lawyer, I wouldn't want to be a lawyer right now. That, you know, certain industries are massively, are going to be hugely impacted, disrupted, as the World Economic Forum says, 25% in the next 5 years. I think that's the quote. So yeah, and I do think there'll be a lot of sideways movement. I think disruption means disruption. It doesn't mean unemployment in the short term. Possibly long term, the consequences are bigger. But I would say to companies, yeah, I think look at AI and find the right solution for you. I think it's pretty evident that the large language models have got it, are really revolutionary at the moment, whereas the image production side of that, less so. I think if you've got a very tight brief and you want a logo designed, you soon realize the limits of AI. If you give it a wide brief, like make me a picture of a cool sports car with a sunset, you'll be like, wow, look at that. But if you say something like, I want a Ferrari Testarossa in red, you know, in front of a mountain, it'll give you some rather weird, possibly abstract version. Not always, but generally that's the case. And I think also that pertains to another issue. And sorry, I'm giving a very long answer. But the other issue is, of course, who owns the data that is passed during the AI's process of delivering you a result? And, you know, there's lots of interesting litigation now, isn't there? I mean, I know Sony and Universal and Warner have got together around the creation of music, because if you said something like, I want a track like the Beatles, and then it comes back and it sounds like the Beatles, well, you have to ask the question, whose copyright has been infringed in the process of listening to, in order to recreate the music, you know, in this case, the Beatles. And that's problematic, isn't it? So, yeah, it could be interesting. We could see problems. We could see, I certainly think we're coming to, a lot of these legal cases are coming to a head. Although that, I'm slightly not answering your question now. I'm getting a bit philosophical. It happens.
I mean, I think what it illustrates is there's a lot of issues to think about with this, isn't there? It's a bit of a minefield. And as you said, we're kind of really at the start of it and nobody quite knows where it's going to take us next. HSBC Innovation Banking, our partner for this episode, provides commercial banking services, expertise, and insights to the technology, life science and healthcare, private equity, and venture capital industries. To find out why innovation needs different, go to www.hsbcinnovationbanking.com/en-gb. Obviously, the Gadget Show was, as you mentioned earlier, very much about testing gadgets and kind of in zany, kind of interesting ways.
Yes.
In a more boring kind of world where businesses have to sort of think about what hardware and what software they need, have you got any sort of tips for how they should go about doing their product testing and, you know, things that they need to bear in mind when deciding what software, hardware to have?
God, that is such a difficult question. What I could say is possibly I could point at some tech trends that might inform purchasing decisions in the short term. And that is that the aforementioned AI is now the next kind of big news round in terms of AI, where the investment has gone and all the stories are going to be written about, is AI on chip. So the likes of NVIDIA, you know, their stock price is going to go through the roof because...
Already has, hasn't it? Isn't it now the richest company in the world?
Yeah, there you go. Shows how much I know. And the likes of Intel and other chip manufacturers are now looking, and Apple, of course, with their own homegrown silicon, are looking to put AI on chip. So in case that's not obvious to some people listening, it means that you can get an AI experience without connecting to the cloud. So at the moment, you may be familiar with the kind of buffering that goes on. It takes an awful long time sometimes for you to get a response, depending on the question you're asking. If you're asking an AI to do something complex, like work out some maths and produce a graph or something, it might take quite a while. Or image production, anything with video, takes absolutely eons. And so the race is on to try and offer quicker AI services locally on chip. And that would include, I'm going to say this, things like watches and other AI devices that they're going to start to get. So watches and phones are going to start to get localized AI implementation based on these tiny, tiny chipsets that the aforementioned chip manufacturers are hard at producing. It was interesting that Apple announced, didn't they, that they're pursuing this route. So that'll be on the iPad, I'm guessing on the iPhone, and I think on the Apple Watch. They've not said it, but I'm pretty sure, because I think the Apple Watch is due for an update. And that'll be the same with the likes of Samsung and Garmin and other smart device manufacturers. We've seen some attempt, haven't we, around other devices like pins. They call them AI pins, wearable badges that you can talk to. No one's really made that work yet. In fact, one of the big innovators in that sector have already gone bust, I think, within a matter of a year. So I'd look at that as an interesting feature set that you might want deployed, or it might pause some purchasing decisions around a fleet of laptops, for example. Wait and see that those AI services, those localized AI services, are available on the device you're going for. And obviously Microsoft as well. I wouldn't be spending a large amount of money on anything from Microsoft right now, because they're about to refresh Windows with, you mentioned Copilot, but with a host of new AI driven services. So yeah, I mean, it's interesting. It's easy for me, isn't it? Because I don't have to invest. I wouldn't be doing anything major for 6 months, because I think we're going to see some really interesting sort of sideways movement, particularly around AI in office tech, hardware and software.
That's a good answer. And yeah, good thoughts.
Sorry, I can't be more specific.
Well, you know, you haven't got a crystal ball, have you, sadly? Although an AI crystal ball is probably the next thing that we'll we'll see on the market.
The crystal ball that I would point any business people to, and I consistently do, using, believe it or not, the very novel exponential roller coaster from Minecraft, which I made with my son, and I put it in my presentations because I do keynotes and corporate speaking, and I like to illustrate the exponential nature of growth. And of course, we're really far up the curve now. We're past the knee of the curve, as Moore, one of the founders of Intel, predicted all that way back in 1965 is when he came up with Moore's Law. Can you believe that? Imagine being that on the ball that you could predict. Isn't that incredible? People don't realize. They think it's like an 80s thing. 65, is it George? I always forget his name wrong. But anyway, Moore, one of the founders of Intel. And so have a look. Think about things exponentially, because if anything is an example of the explosive nature of growth in the tech sector, then it's AI, isn't it? Because it feels like, especially with OpenAI, one minute they announce a large language model that blows everything up to that point out of the water. Next, their CEO's been fired. Then he's then he's back.
It was a bit of a mess, wasn't it?
It's incredible, isn't it? So it's exciting, but I wouldn't want to be making decisions.
It's a roller coaster journey, in fact, isn't it?
Beautifully put.
Well, actually, on that theme of roller coasters, and you mentioned earlier about, you know, VR headsets, and I must say that the best experience I've ever had with a VR headset is going on a roller coaster. I thought that was immense fun.
Yeah.
But the vision for that, the vision for those is beyond just kind of entertainment and sort of be part of our working lives, you know, and this concept of the metaverse, which was everywhere until ChatGPT kind of rather spoilt the party and put the focus back on AI. Everybody was talking about the metaverse, especially obviously Meta, that changed its, was so excited about it, all changed its name. What are your thoughts on the metaverse? Is it dead, or is it still coming?
God, no, it's not dead. That's one of my favorite subjects. By the way, it's Gordon Moore. I couldn't let your listeners.
Gordon. Yes, I was going to try and help you out, but then I was Charles, and that's how I would have been wrong too.
It's when you're put on the spot, you know. So basically, I think, yes, it was interesting, wasn't it? I think to a certain extent, Facebook changing their name to Meta and going all in was a little premature and took the shine off what has been our kind of inevitable evolution towards a shared virtual experience within a mixed reality environment. So what I often do is, when I talk about this, is I'll refer to my glasses, which you're not looking at my glasses right now. As you might remember, they're very large and very white. And I make a joke at my events and I'll say, I went to the opticians and I said, I'll have that pair, please. And he said, I'm sorry, sir, that's the shop window. And this is my way of making the point that my glasses are rather large. But the point I'm making is that actually I wear large glasses on my head, you know, 24 hours a day or whatever it is, 12 hours a day. And they're very comfortable and I get along with them. And we're not far away from the implementation of small, efficient batteries in them and some sort of imaging device, not dissimilar to the sort of experience you now get on, you know, your Quest 3 or, more to the point, the Apple Vision Pro, which is a mixed reality experience. So I'm sure everyone listening knows what I'm talking about. But just in case, you've got virtual reality where you're fully immersed. You've then got mixed or augmented reality where you're augmenting the real world that you can see. So for me right now, sitting in my office, I can see my microphone and all my camera equipment and musical equipment and so on and so forth in my office. But if I wanted to, possibly using my voice, I could paint these objects with data information. If you and I were chatting at an event, your LinkedIn might pop up above your head, mine might pop up, and with some form of gesture, let's make it silly, let's say that we wink at each other and then we share our LinkedIn information. This is what I'm talking about. And we're so close to that. For some people that might be abhorrent, they might find that awful, but for you know, certain types of social media, certain types of business scenarios, teaching scenarios, public speaking scenarios, navigational scenarios, you can see how powerful that is, can't you? Where you know, and right now, you know, if you want it to, you're kind of you get this persistent content, don't you? So you watch the aforementioned Game of Thrones. I was watching on my TV in the bedroom last night, and then I could get on the train today and I'll finish my work, so I could pull up my phone, and of course I'll continue from the point that I finished watching last night in the bedroom on my phone on the train. Yeah. And that, and so the, you know, all of the things that the stars are aligning, the way, all the various aspects that we need to finally put down our smartphones, wave goodbye to the kind of Egyptian tablet version 4.0 that is the smartphone, and move to our next stage of digital imaging, and that's, it's going to be worn on our face. So I think that's where the metaverse will be. And of course, the metaverse concept is slightly wider. I'm realize my answers are very, very long, so I'll make this super brief. But there will be a commerce and a kind of shared set of features and customer experiences within that. And that's what the metaverse, of course, does more widely. It means that, for example, if I buy a pair of virtual trainers in a game, I could wear those virtual trainers in a music event that I'm using on, you know, within my kind of Meta account. I don't mean Meta as in Facebook, I mean the more general use of the phrase Meta.
That sort of is a good vision of what, where we might be heading, I think. Actually, we're coming kind of towards the end, and I couldn't possibly let you go without letting you share some of your kind of standout moments from the Gadget Show, you know, in terms of both good and bad experiences and the gadgets that you've loved the best. So what would you say was kind of the best gadget that you tried, and wow, did you have any terrible experiences when you were testing things?
Oh, I had lots of terrible experiences, like you know, like having to trek across the Welsh mountains and in some big challenge where we were using the sort of first generation of domestic GPSs and getting lost and you know, freezing cold, and then, or getting put in an ice bath outdoors somewhere in Scotland, or, you know, the sort of rugged stuff that we used to do. And if you lost the challenge, you'd end up sleeping in a tent, freezing cold. And if you won, you'd be in a nice warm Winnebago, you know. But generally, it was an amazing 12 years, because that's how long I did the series for on Channel 5, of great experiences, testing amazing things. A personal submarine I tested in a lake in California. That was amazing. And I put, I think I mentioned it earlier, actually, but you maybe thought I was making it up, but I really did put two jet engines on a skateboard, and we broke an existing world record.
To levitate, because
I would love that. That would be great. Marty McFly all the way. No, this was like a street luge, feet first, on a big runway, and we shot forward feet first, and I reached 118 miles an hour, which was a world record. And would you believe, I had a throttle for two jet engines, was a piece of string, and my brakes were my boots, my motorbike boots. So it wasn't in any way safe, but it was fun. And of course, Robo Jace, who is the robotic version of me that we created to talk, actually, to many of the points that we've been chatting about today, to look at chatbots and how convincing they could be and whether they could make a version of me that could host the show. Back then, of course, it wasn't possible. But if you hooked it up to something like ChatGPT-4, oh, I think it might do a better job now. But interestingly, just to join it to our latest venture, which of course is the Gadget Show podcast, which I'd love your listeners to listen to, which is available on all the, you know, all the podcasting platforms, but also in video form on YouTube, for example. It was wonderful. I didn't know what they'd brought in. A couple of the guys that we used to use to make lots of the gadgets that we made ourselves, because we were also, you know, Heath Robinson style kind of gadget inventors on the show. And they brought a shrouded Robo Jace. So they brought him back. And I hadn't seen Robo Jace, my robotic doppelganger, for many years. And interestingly, it was very funny when they revealed him. You have to watch the episode, actually. But without giving too much away, I'm going to say he hadn't fared very well in the storage cupboard.
Oh, no.
Yes, I'm just going to say that. It was, honestly, it was so hilarious. It was so, so funny. So, yeah, I hope that, I mean, I don't know what, if you remember the show. And, of course, the competition, that's the other thing that people ask me in the street, you know. They'll say, oh, that competition was nuts. And for anyone listening that doesn't know what I'm talking about, we really invented the idea on that TV show of those competitions where you get endless amounts of stuff. And we just went nuts. We would have like 100 different things, you know, a 32-inch TV for the dining room, a 48-inch TV for the kitchen, a 21-inch TV for the bedroom, you know, and it was just ridiculous. And we had cars and drones and robot lawnmowers and, you know, food mixers, you name it, you know, 100 devices worth, you know, tens of thousands of pounds, and one person would win it. And it was nuts.
That does sound a move on from the generation game.
Oh, yeah. Very much so. Yeah, I'm old enough to remember the generation game myself too.
Cuddly teddy bear.
Yeah, really, really similar. And sometimes I would surprise them and I'd go along with the lorry. And I remember when we met someone, I thought we were meeting them at their house, and we were meeting them at a lockup because their house wasn't big enough for all the stuff they'd won.
Wow. Well, it sounds like there's lots more things to test, including, you know, you can levitate now. You can attach jet engines to yourself and fly across lakes. So there's a challenge for
okay,
you
that's,
for
yeah.
the podcast.
You've done that as well. Yeah, done that with, well, Frankie Zapata you're talking about. He was the original guy who first of all made the water-powered jetpack and water-powered jetboard. And I tested that in the water in south of France with him. And he's the guy now that you see flying around on an actual jet platform, isn't it? He's amazing. And there's those guys that have them on their arms, aren't there? Have you seen those ones?
Yeah. Yes, I have. And I didn't want to get too close, I have to say.
No,
yeah,
terrifying.
So much more for you to test. And really interesting that you're coming back in podcast form. So good luck with all of that. But sadly, that's all we have time for on this week's edition of the UKTM podcast. Thanks to Jason Bradbury for sharing those amazing stories with us. And thanks to everyone who's listening. We'll be back with another episode next week. But in the meantime, you can keep up to date with all the latest UK tech developments at www.uktech.news. Don't forget to follow UKTN on LinkedIn and X, where you can also get in touch with me at Jane Wakefield with your comments and suggestions about the show. Until next time, goodbye from me. HSBC Innovation Banking, our partner for this episode, provides commercial banking services, expertise, and insights to the technology, life science and healthcare, private equity, and venture capital industries. To find out why innovation needs different, go to www.hsbcinnovationbanking.com/en-gb.